the Gospel of Luke 7, 18 to 28, and some of the same themes that we just saw in Zephaniah of people within the people, hiddenness, trusting that Yahweh has delivered and will deliver it even when it doesn't look maybe like He's delivering, are also here in Luke 7, starting at verse 18. This is Luke's account of the question of the baptizer to Jesus about His identity, and then Jesus teaching about Him. It's somewhat different than Matthew, but Luke has his own emphases. So we'll just kind of read quickly through the text, and then I think if we situate this in its context, fairly near narrative context, that'll work pretty well. So verse 18, it's kind of out of the blue. John the Baptizer has not been mentioned since 320, when it said that Herod added this to all of his other issues that he put John in prison. So John has kind of disappeared, essentially, from the narrative since then. So, verse 18, Kai ap engelon Ioane hoi mathetai autu peri panton tuton. The disciples of him and the disciples of him announced to John or proclaimed to John about all these things. The verb there is from ap angelo. It's a liquid stem, so it's got a different strong third principal part. It's just an aorist indicative active third plural. And after he had summoned proskoleomai to certain ones of his disciples, the John, verse 19, empepsen, aorist indicative, sent to the Lord saying, now here's a question, emphatic you, are you the coming one or another? Shall we, a deliberative subjunctive there from prosdakao, or shall we expect another? Verse 20, after they had arrived from paraginomai to him, the men said, see, Luke actually has the question delivered twice. I think he wants us to take the question seriously. So they show up to Jesus, and the men said, John the Baptizer, or the Baptist, sent us to you saying, and here's the quote within the quote. Is this an embedded sentence, Bill? I'm not sure. Su eho erkamenos, are you the coming one, or another shall we expect? Verse 21, in that hour, or at that time, he healed many from diseases and torments and evil spirits, and tiflois polois echarisita. Charizomai means, it can mean to forgive, actually. It means to graciously give. So here, he graciously gave to many blind people blepain, to see. And to sound like Dr. Veltz for just a second, maybe this present infinitive can be inceptive, to begin to see. I just wanted you to know that I knew that, how to parse that form. And answering, he said to them, I'm not sure we should think of the guy showing up and then Jesus says, hold on a second, and then he goes, chung, 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 you know, and then heals a bunch of people. Maybe it happened that way, but it was going on all over the place, right? And then verse 22, and answering, he said to them, poruthentes, going, go up angelata, announce to John, ha, it's a relative pronoun, neuter plural, the things which you saw and you heard. And now Jesus tells them what they just saw and heard. Blind people are recovering sight, lame people are walking, lepers are being cleansed, katha ridzon tai, there's the passive ending, and deaf people are hearing, dead people are being raised, poor people are being good newsed. And of course, these it's kind of a pastiche or a gathering of phrases from Isaiah 29 and 35 and 61. All lists of reversals, Bill, again from Zephaniah, that will happen in the age of salvation. So Jesus is saying the age of salvation is happening. But there's something odd about it, right? Which is why he has to say, verse 23, and we'll come back to this, and blessed is, makarios esten, hos e'on, this is just e'on in place of on, so hos on, whoever is not caused to be stumbleized, en emoi, normally taken causally, because of me. End of first paragraph. Now, the pericope, I think, quite rightly takes us through at least verse 28. We have a genitive absolute. The angels of John having departed, literally. Of course, angelos just means messenger, and here's one of the few examples you get in the New Testament where an angelos is just a human being. And when the messengers of John had departed, he, Jesus, began to say to the crowds about John, why, te ex elthate, why did y'all go out into the desert place? Or, you could read it, what, because the accusative of the interrogative pronoun te can be why or what. Maybe we'll take it that latter way. What did you go out into the desert to behold? Did you go out to behold a kalaman hippa anemu saliu amanon, a reed which is being shaken by wind? Likely a metaphor for somebody that vacillates back and forth, although there's discussion about that. The answer is clearly no, because Jesus answers again in verse 25, but what did you go out again to see? A man in soft clothes being garbed? Extra dessert for anybody that knows the form of amphiesmenon. This is from amphienemi, and it's actually a perfect participle passive. I knew that because I'm so smart and because I looked it up. Idu, look, those in splendid clothing and luxury, go all the way to the participle, hoi hipparchontes. Those who are in splendid clothing and luxury are not in royal clothing, but they are entois basileois asin. They are in the royal places, in king's houses. John clearly isn't in king's house. He's in a king's jail, right? This doesn't look right. This is like Dr. Okamoto. His summary of Lutheran theology, at least in part, is this doesn't look right. I mean, so that John the Baptizer is a good Lutheran, right? Verse 26, but what did you go out to see? A prophetain, a prophet? Nigh, lego, you mean. Yes, I say to you, and here's the comparative adjective, something greater of a prophet, the genitive of comparison after the comparative. And now Jesus explains why Jesus is not just a prophet. It's because this one is concerning whom it stands written. And now the quote is mostly from Malachi 3. There's some wording from Exodus 23 as well, but we'll just focus on Malachi. Behold, I am sending my angel, my messenger, before your face, who, kates huase, will prepare, there's the future, indicative active, the way of you before you. Again, Malachi 3 talks about the one who will prepare the way before Yahweh, the way of the Lord. But here it's the way of Jesus. Get it? Jesus is Yahweh coming, right? And Malachi 3:1 is an eschatological passage talking about the terrible day of Yahweh. So John, even though he's in jail, and even though he's asking these questions, is nevertheless so great that Jesus can say, verse 28, I say to you, we have to go into the end of the clause, no one who deis estin is greater, made zone, the comparative of megas, among the born ones of women of John, that is, greater than John. But the one who is littler, this is a comparative form from Macross, but often these comparatives are superlative in force, so we'll take it, the least in the reign of God, made zone out to Estin, is greater than John. Is this putting John down? No. It's exalting the reign of God. It's exalting the new thing that has begun in Jesus and the new thing that John, in fact, has prophesied and for which he's been the forerunner. Now, I kind of wish that the lectionary would read verses 29 and 30. Because I think this is an important part of the theme. And so we'll just read it quickly. And all the people, when they heard, and the tax collectors, they declared God just. They justified God because they had been baptized. This is a retained accusative. We won't go into that. With the baptism of John. Verse 30, but the Pharisees and the lawyers nullified God's will for themselves. Why? Because they had not been baptized by him. So notice who's rejoicing. It's the outcasts, it's the lowly, it's the ones that you would look at and say those are the least important. Now, what's going on here in the context? Maybe just a minute or two about that. At the beginning of chapter 7, we have the centurion story. And the centurion, as you remember, Luke gives us the added information that it was the elders of the synagogue who presented the centurion's request. And what do they say about the centurion? He's worthy. Jesus starts heading towards his house. He sends a message back and he says, I'm not worthy. See, it's not about me. It's about you because you have authority. And even I, a centurion, understand what authority is about. Jesus is amazed at his faith. See? So, Jesus has authority for those who are not worthy. The next story is the raising of the son of the widow of Nain. We talk about a person in need. I mean, two people in need. One's dead, right? And the other's a widow, and this was her only son. And Jesus has compassion, again, upon the littlest, the lowliest. He marvels at the faith of a Gentile soldier, right? He has compassion upon a widow and upon her dead son. And now John's question comes. See, so the Jesus that we see in chapter 7 is the Jesus who responds to those who have faith in him, even though they themselves are unworthy. He has compassion upon those in need. This is a very happy Jesus. Everything is great. And now John sends this question. What's the kicker? John's in jail. Right? And in chapter 9, it's going to be subtly known that Herod has chopped his head off. So the question is, are you the right one? Not just when you make things better, not just when you respond in obvious ways to our need, but and notice that it's a little unfair. Jesus doesn't say, go tell John I've just sprung him loose. You know, well, why not? He raised the widow of Nain's son from death. Couldn't Jesus have sprung John from prison? And I suppose the answer is probably, yeah, he could have, but he didn't. But see, this is a great text, actually, for people who are struggling. This is a great text for people who want to know, you know, who is it and what is it that I can hold on to? And the answer, of course, is, blessed is the one who is not caused to stumble because of me. See, I'm the right Jesus. I'm the one. I'm bringing God's reign. Ultimately, I will raise all the dead and heal all the sick and restore sight to all the blind. Right? But there will be times when I won't give you what you think you need. See, in those times, nevertheless, blessed is the one who is not caused to stumble because of me. So it's kind of a tough text, you know. And for life when it seems grim, and yet it's a great opportunity to proclaim that, yes, Christ does fulfill the promises, and of course you take it all the way to the cross, right? And then ultimately you can proclaim the final day, you know, the day which is coming, says the Lord. But the promise of who Christ is enough for his people to hold on to even when the prison door doesn't get thrown. So, and you could go on and on, but hey, I got class. Thanks a lot.